Right eye dominant.
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 This is the Right Eye Dominant Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I am your host, Nick Toro Jr., and I'm excited to share today's episode with you, where I have special guest Lena Frisch. Lena is the curator of modern and contemporary art at the Ashmolean Museum at the University of Oxford in England. She's a specialist in 20th and 21st century Japanese art and photography. And her name happens to appear on the front cover of a really great compendium of Japanese photography since 1945. It is entitled Ravens and Red Lipstick. She is the author of this book. She conducted numerous interviews and really goes into depth about Japanese photography since World War II, something that I am very personally interested in myself, and realized that I didn't really know that much about Japanese photography other than a couple of the big names like Daito Moriyama or Nobuyoshi Araki. So I really was excited to talk to Lena about the whole world of Japanese photography, and specifically that of Japan since the end of World War II. So that's where our conversation goes. I think you'll see in this conversation, we really get into a lot of interesting topics, and I hope you learn a little something. I know I did, and find this interview as enjoyable as I found it. So without further ado, let's get into today's discussion, my interview with Lena Frisch. Thanks for listening. Well, welcome to the podcast, Lena.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking time out to talk with me today. We are talking today specifically about Japanese photography. We're talking about your book, Ravens and Red Lipstick, which I have sitting right here, which I am a fan of Japanese photography. And then when I got this book, I realized there's so much I don't know about Japanese photography, certainly contemporary Japanese photography. And so I thought it would be great to have you on the show and just talk about the topic. So can you just, as an introduction for the audience, just tell me about your background, your education, and what brought you specifically to, I know you're a Japanese art expert, but Japanese art and photography.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I should start at the very beginning. So I lived in Japan as a child. So that's where my whole Japan connection comes from. I lived in Osaka for 1.5 years. I went to Japanese kindergarten. So Japanese is my second language. I'm originally from Germany. And then, yeah, the second language that I've actually never lost is Japanese. So I don't look Japanese and I'm not Japanese, but there is a part of me that is Japanese, I would say. Because I guess when you're 4 or 5 years old, that's a very kind of crucial time in your development. And particularly at the time in the 80s, you know, there were no other white kids. So I was I felt very Japanese after a short time, I guess. So that's where the whole Japan connection comes from. And then I went to Japanese school every Saturday once we moved back to Germany. And that was always part of my life. And then art was always part of my life as well, because I was just always really interested in it. I love drawing. I love painting. And then as a teenager, I did a photography workshop that I really liked. I think I was 13 or 14 years old and developed an interest in photography. And then basically what happened was when I was 19, I decided to move to Tokyo and did an internship in a Japanese company right after graduating. So and I was still thinking, what do I want to do with my life? What do I want to learn and study at university? And I went to this Japanese company. It was absolutely really not what I wanted to do. So I realized, okay, studying economics or business and Japanese, which was kind of, you know, one idea that I had been thinking about, is definitely not it. But I used to go to museums, and I started to really love art even more. And so I decided I want to study art history, but I also want to study Japanese studies. And then in those, you know, studying Japanese and studying art history and learning more about art, at some point I had to think about my master's thesis, and my supervisor then said, oh, you know, you have this Japanese interest, you have this interest in contemporary art. Why don't you do something about Morimura Yasumasa? Who at the time I didn't know. And Morimura Yasumasa is a Japanese photography appropriation artist. So a little bit like the Japanese male version of Cindy Sherman, you could say. And that actually got me into Japanese photography. So I studied then at Keio University in Tokyo, and I met Morimura-san. And so basically, unlike many other people who got into Japanese photography because they're interested in Moriyama and kind of provoke and all that, I got really interested in Japanese photography from the photography of the 90s and kind of 80s, 90s, or even newer. And then I gradually went backwards. Yeah, and then I decided to do my PhD about Japanese photography as well. And I guess that's how it all started.
Wow. Okay, so from Germany to Japan, you've clearly spent a lot of time in England as well, right?
Yeah, but that's much later, actually. So I've been living in London for 10 years now, just over 10 years. After doing my PhD, I decided that I really wanted to work in a museum. And so I started in Berlin at the National Museums Berlin. And then a job at Tate Modern came up, which kind of had my name on it because it was focusing on art from the Asia Pacific region, including photography, including Japanese art, and at Tate. So I thought, you know, this is absolutely wonderful. And so that's where I started my curatorial career.
And when was that at the Tate?
That was in 2013. And then I stayed there for just under 5 years. And now I'm at the Ashmolean Museum and employed by the University of Oxford, where I'm the curator of modern and contemporary art.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that whole background. Appreciate that. And just out of curiosity, were you at Tate Modern when they did a William Klein Daido Moriyama exhibit? Were you involved with that?
Yes, so that was actually before I was officially employed there, but I did a small kind of internship while I was still working on my PhD. Basically, I already had my PhD, but I was preparing it for publication, which you have to do in Germany in order to get your title. You have to publish it as a book. And I was working on that for about a year and lived in London for a year at the time as well. And at the time, I then helped Simon Baker, who was the curator of that exhibition, with all the Japanese side of things, so translating texts. So the Moriyama part of the exhibition has a catalogue, and the William Klein part of the exhibition has a catalogue. And for the Moriyama part, I translated all the Japanese essays into English.
Wow. Okay. That's, yeah. And I actually had very early on this season had an episode where I spoke with David Campney about William Klein. And I knew that Klein had done photography in Japan and had done a book on Tokyo, but the connections, the visual connections, I actually never really saw it just until they were really right next to each other. And the influence that Klein had on Moriyama was, I mean, it was a little bit of a lightning bolt for me. And then it was like just so obvious once I really dug into it. But it was, I backtracked to that specific exhibit at the Tate Modern. Let's talk about Japanese photography then. And you brought up something interesting. So you were first exposed to it in the 90s and were at the time that was the contemporary scene that was going on that coincided with you being there. I do want to sort of jump back and just do this maybe chronologically or historically, focusing on where you go with the book and the post-war photography after World War II. Can you just maybe talk to me a little bit about what the atmosphere was like right after World War II, not just so much from a obviously post-war recovery, but how, like, what was photography or the art world or scene like in Japan at that time?
So I would say, if we kind of simplify a little bit, I would say the, you know, post-war period was really a time when photography in Japan was dominated by the realism movement. So photography was all about kind of recording as kind of straight photography what was going on in Japan at the time, kind of people's everyday life struggles, you know, rebuilding the cities, all that kind of post-war, you know, struggles. And I guess key names would be Kimura Ihe or Dōmon Ken, who are both kind of seen as the fathers of post-war photography in Japan, who were already active before. So not just, you know, before the war, but then the big moments was particularly after the war. And there was a massive, massive amateur photography movement as well. I think that's quite important to remember. And kind of, I always talk about a photography world, kind of thinking about the Japanese terminology as well. So the photography world in Japan really consists of big photography magazines, particularly at the time. And then there are photo galleries, there are photo editors, and then, of course, a massive photo industry. So after the war, the Japanese photo industry became bigger than the German photo industry, which until then had kind of dominated the world market. So Japanese photography at the time really has to be seen in this context of just a massive enthusiasm for photography in general, both on the professional side and on the amateur side. And so, yeah, photography at the time was seen as straight photography, as kind of realist photography, as you're trying to document what is going on. And we shouldn't forget the term photography in Japanese also means kind of recording something, some kind of truth. And so I guess at the time, photography was really trying to do that.
And what's the Japanese term for that?
Shashin.
Right. Okay.
And it consists of the characters sha and shin. So, you know, in Japanese, you use the Chinese characters. And that really would then translate as kind of recording a truth or kind of a core.
Mm-hmm. Which is counter to sort of like the English or the roots of, like, I guess, hearkening back to Greek, writing with light. That's very different.
Yeah.
And I think is very telling then, because how that can inform sort of the, no pun intended, but like the focus of what photographers were doing. It's broader in some ways and it's narrower in others. And as far as straight photography is concerned, that makes a lot of sense, that it's recording truth in a very literal sense. However, then I think and I know we'll probably touch on this as the conversation goes on, but as Japanese photography morphs or changes through the years, just based on a lot of what I've seen, it moves away from documenting sort of reality or truth. And yet that term, then I think the truth becomes relative, right? So it's the, like, what's the truth of the individual photographer and what they're doing with the medium at that
point. Exactly. And if we just look at the characters, that character truth is a very, you know, it can be a kind of philosophical truth. It can be all kinds of different truths. It doesn't have to be the kind of reality truth, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So it's exactly as you say, kind of it, you know, what is maybe, you know, later on what photographers have been doing or did was even more recording a truth. It's just mm-hmm. a different kind of truth.
A different kind of truth, right. So on that note, do you think that the reality based image making of that time was just a direct response to the world that they found themselves living in post-war, just the having to rebuild and reconstruct? Is it also, and this is coming from a point of ignorance on my part, but is there something within the sort of the Japanese history or artistic lineage that was a logical response? And I'm asking that because, you know, if you look at what, like, American painters were doing post-war and the rise of abstract expressionism, it's almost like this rejection of reality in a lot of ways. So can you maybe talk about why they went there?
I think there are all kinds of reasons. And it's not like photography was always only straight photography, because if we think about all this strong, for example, surrealism movement in Japan, and all these different photo clubs in the 1930s or even earlier, then of course there was a very kind of artistic photography. There is this very strong artistic photography history in Japan, actually. But yeah, as you say, I think it has a lot to do with the kind of trauma of the war, that afterwards it was more, you know, as you just mentioned, abstract expressionism, kind of, you know, after the war, you know, people said, okay, we can't really paint in a figurative way anymore. And, you know, what was art? We couldn't really do anything to kind of stop the war. So, you know, therefore we just create abstract works. And I guess in Japan, it was more like, and therefore in terms of photography, we just really record what is going on rather than trying to create something kind of, you know, yeah, artistic, if you will. But we also need to remember that photography in Japan, the whole kind of within this larger context of art in Japan, that, you know, kind of after Japan was forced to open its borders in the late 19th century by the Western powers, Western art concept was kind of brought to Japan. Even the word bijutsu, so art, was something that was kind of brought from outside. So this whole context of kind of art schools, photography and photography education, all of that kind of was, you know, they were kind of quite divided as well. So there was less kind of freedom to do whatever you wanted to do as a photographer. But I guess if you chose photography, then at the time you would kind of go down that route of kind of straight photography. And if you chose to paint in a Western style, you would kind of learn how to paint in a Western style. If you decided to paint in a Japanese style, then you would go down that route and learn with, you know, those teachers. So it was all kind of, you know, there were different categories.
Okay. So as far as, I think we touched a little bit on the second question, Japanese post-war photography and how it differs from the West. I think we danced around that a little bit, so I'm going to move on from that. But it seems you mentioned, and I know a little bit about this from my study, the presence of magazines as an outlet for photography, and also the proliferation of Japanese camera manufacturing, which you mentioned before the war. Obviously, Germany was at the forefront of that. I think those two elements being present in Japan obviously fueled the growth of the medium, not only, like, as you mentioned, the amateur photography world, but also in an artistic way and commercial way, I'm sure, as well. Yep. Can you talk a little bit about both those influences and just maybe explain, like, where that came from? The magazine element to me makes a little bit more sense only because, you know, worldwide mass media at that point was one of the main outlets. But the camera manufacturing, like, how did that come about, and how did those two influences combine?
Well, maybe just going back to the journals first, because I think what we also should do is see it in the wider context of Japanese kind of journals and book production as well. So, of course, there had already been this whole history of, you know, kind of paper and of books and of manga. So, you know, kind of Japan is a country where just so many books are produced all the time and so many magazines and journals. And so the kind of photojournal has to be also seen in that context. And then camera manufacturing. What's interesting about that is also, Japan wanted, after, you know, Japan was forced to open its borders, there was this whole, the so-called Meiji era. And that's a time when Japan was really trying to be, to keep up with the West, and to show that it can be as, you know, how do you say, kind of industrially as advanced as the West. And, you know, it was kind of really, all of a sudden, Japan developed in a super, super quick way. So as of the late 19th century, and then until until for about 100 years, I would say. And so I think that kind of manufacturing, and to be really good at that, can also be seen in that context of just trying to be, you know, the best in that field. And it led definitely to a big love for cameras. So I remember talking to quite a few Japanese photographers who said, oh, you know, in the post-war years, and I'm probably talking about until the 70s, 80s, there were so many people who were not in love with photography, but in love with a camera. They would just love all this technical stuff, you know, and the photo clubs, because there were all these amateur photography clubs in universities and in schools and sometimes even in larger companies. Many people who went to these clubs were, it was just all about the camera. And so that's actually, I think, quite interesting to keep that in mind when we talk about photography, that when it comes to that era of analog photography, it was all about, you know, technically not only about the print, but also about the camera and what the camera can do.
Mm. And I have made one trip to Japan, and the used camera stores there are like just a kid in a candy store, as far as not only the variety of them, but I think just thinking about how much they respect the object itself. Some people would not even remove the sort of the protective plastic wrap from their cameras the entire time, or keep every box or insert. It's almost like a fetishization of this object. So it's interesting, but the value of it to the collector or the user or the amateur, but then also this focus on manufacturing and having that being an industry that they clearly wanted to excel at and innovate in, so many advances in just camera technology coming out of Japan all those years is just staggering. Let's talk a little bit then about the world of Japanese photography, specifically post-World War II, going into like the late 60s, early 1970s. Obviously, worldwide political and social upheaval. But I know that there were definite events or upheavals in Japan that directly influenced the world of photography. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think there are two strands to kind of consider. One is the photography strand itself, so what we talked about before, which is this kind of focus on realism and on straight photography, on recording how life really is. And after a while, the photographers started to rebel against that, and they wanted to do something else. And then the second strand is that we just, as you said, you know, the overall political, socio-political situation. And in the Japanese context, Japan was still kind of semi-occupied by the US, and there was this so-called Anpo movement, which was a movement against the renewal of a contract, a treaty between the US and Japan, which for all kinds of reasons people in Japan were against. One reason being that, well, the main reason being that Japan just wasn't really free. People wanted to gain their independence back. And you know, things like the US military bases were, of course, still there. And people were able to, like, you know, from the US people from those bases were able to get there and kind of to travel freely between those bases, and had a kind of special status. And so I think there was this relationship with the West. It was a really difficult one at the time, because there was a kind of sense of admiration towards the West, but of course a strong sense of frustration as well, and a will to regain independence. And so those years in the 1960s and 70s are the years when there were the largest protests in Japan in its history, actually. And within that context, the art scene in Japan, there was just a strong interest of, you know, again, being kind of, people were happy to express their anger a little bit more. They were critical, and there was this feeling of just also trying new things. So in terms of photography, photographers said, okay, photography shouldn't only be about straight photography and recording some kind of, you know, reality as in kind of straight photography, but we can use the medium for other things as well. Let's be a bit more experimental, and photography can be about what we want it to be. So, I mean, important groups at the time, the first group that I always mention is the Vivo group, which was a group of photographers that it was only active for 2 years, But people like Kawada Kikuji, Hosoi Eiko were part of the group, Tomatsu Shome. And their photography was a much more subjective photography and sometimes quite symbolic photography. And it clearly moved away from this idea of recording a simple outside truth. It was a lot more about an inside truth.
Hmm. So does that then, I'll lead the witness. So does that then lead us to Provoke and the Provoke era, or like the Vivo group, I think was a direct leading to it.
There is a direct leading to it because, for example, Moriyama Daido, who's probably seen as the kind of key figure of Provoke, just also because he's still so active. Moriyama Daido was an assistant in the Vivo studio. He printed in the Vivo darkroom. And then when Vivo was dissolved, he became Hosoe Eiko's personal assistant. And he always mentions Tomatsu Shome as one of his greatest kind of inspirations as well. So clearly directly influenced by the Vivo group. And as a side note, because we talked about William Klein earlier on, when William Klein was in Japan, he actually printed some of his photographs in the Vivo darkroom. And I remember talking to Kawada Kikuji about this, and he said, oh, I think William Klein, you know, expected something a bit more grand. And then he came and then he heard, oh, there's this Vivo group. And he kind of also still expected something a bit more spectacular. And then there were just these young men who had a small little dark room. But yeah, that's where he actually then got his works printed when he was in Tokyo.
Wow. To be just kind of a fly on the wall at that time,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
would be really amazing. So let's talk about Provoke then. For my listeners, maybe just give sort of like the intro and the significance of it.
Yeah, so Provoke is actually the name of a magazine. And so it was Nakahira Takuma, Moriyama Daido. So Moriyama Daido joined as of the second issue of this magazine. And the idea of this magazine or journal was to really question photography to its absolute core, to be experimental, to kind of ask again the question, what is photography? What should photography be? And so it was really a journal in which they not only published photographs, but in which they also published texts about photography, and in which they kind of talked about what photography should be. It's a very experimental journal, which at the time, at the beginning, it had a very small print run. Not many people knew about it, but then within quite a short time, it became influential within the history of Japanese photography. And then within a short time, people also started to associate the photographers who had founded the magazine, they started to call them the Provoke photographers. So suddenly the name Provoke was not only the name of the journal anymore, but also of the photographers themselves. And kind of an aesthetic which has been associated with the Provoke movement is this very blurry, grainy style of photography, of black and white photography, of course. And Moriyama Daido in particular, his work was then soon called Are Bure Bokeh, which means kind of grainy, blurry, out of focus. And I guess in a way that's an aesthetic that you can still find in some of his photographs today. And really questioning photography from its core, even kind of, do you always have to look through the finder, or can you just hold the finder somewhere? Because if you look through the finder, then you're already kind of making a decision because you choose the frame. But if you kind of just shoot from the hip or so, then, you know, there's a stronger element of chance that's involved. Mm-hmm. So we really have to see it as a kind of, you know, kind of late 60s, 70s experimental, very innovative type of photography, which I think now in the kind of world history of photography, people have over the last 10-15 years started to understand how relevant this movement actually was internationally.
Yeah. I always equate provoke era Japanese photography with like the Velvet Underground, right? So they're like this obscure, overlooked in many ways during their productivity years, but then like the influence, the old adage is very few people heard the Velvet Underground, but they all started a band because of it. And so to me, the provoke always has sort of this same aura to it. And maybe that's also me sort of, I don't know, maybe idealizing it to a certain extent, but to see how challenging the work was, but then also to see those influences still obvious today. It's just, to me, it brings a certain level of importance to it that it's interesting. They weren't necessarily in the spotlight as much when they were actually active. Is that correct?
That's definitely correct. Yeah. I mean, there were maybe within a certain kind of, photography scene, people kind of then started to hear about them and know about them. And of course, Moriyama Daido, for example, he then became quite successful in Japan within quite a short period of time, at least so successful that he could, you know, live as a photographer without being associated to a magazine or so. But I mean, I remember talking to Araki once, who then said, who's just a little bit younger than the provoke photographers, but not very much. And he said they were kind of like an underground bomb. But in an interview in the 90s, I remember how he actually still said, oh, nobody has heard of provoke outside of Japan, but they were actually quite influential and important for kind of my generation, or they're slightly younger photographers. And I thought it was so interesting because then, you know, just 10 years later, everyone also in the West was talking about provoke. But in the 90s, still nobody knew what provoke was outside of a kind of group. Certain group of photography aficionados in Japan.
Was there a Western influence on the group? Because it's like I look at that work and I see its influence on contemporary photography just in general. And certainly if you look at, you know, like that blurry, out of focus, high grain, high contrast, or even like a street aesthetic in a lot of ways has sort of become pretty common in photo circles now, going back to the William Klein connection, or I think about Robert Frank and what he was doing. Were they merging in Western influences at the time?
For sure, yeah. I mean, William Klein definitely. I mean, Moriyama was really looking at, you know, his William Klein's New York photographs. So definitely though. And also, I mean, of course, it was more difficult at the time. I think we tend to forget that now in this kind of globalized internet world. But at the time, it was not always that easy to get hold of Western materials. But of course, they were looking at, you know, Western photo magazines and Western books, and were quite interested in it. But many of those Japanese photographers were not able to travel outside of Japan. I mean, Moriyama went to New York and to the US and traveled, but many other photographers were not able to do that. But yes, there is definitely an influence from Western photography and also other art. So Andy Warhol is definitely a big influence. Pop art was a massive influence actually as well in general. So there was, you know, I always think it's quite interesting to think about, you know, different kind of cities as hotspots within art history and the history of photography. And I think Tokyo in the 1960s, and then also particularly also 70s around the Tokyo Olympics, was quite an important city. And there were people who went to the US and then came back to Japan and brought back new influences. People like Yoko Ono, who then suddenly came back to Tokyo for a while, Yayoi Kusama, who went to the US, went back. So there were all these people who kind of connected the Tokyo and New York, in particular, actually those two cities, there was a strong link also in fields of graphic design, for example. So, and so that's actually also important to think about that time as a time where not only were there links between different countries and between different cities, but also between different artistic media. So people like Yoko Tadanori, you know, a major important, very pop style graphic design artist in Japan. He was working with photographers. I mean, there are these wonderful posters of him and collaborating with Hosoe Eiko, for example. So suddenly photography wasn't only in its own little world anymore, but it was, you know, kind of collaborating with other artistic media.
But you bring up another interesting point that, and something I think that's lost on maybe younger generations, is the difficulty of accessing material, information, books, magazines, music, film. Just the, we have such a luxury of access online now where everything's so immediate. And just to think that not that long ago, that was a completely different reality. And so I think that also maybe lends itself to these movements that are able to gestate on their own and create their own sort of, lack of a better term, but just their own aesthetic, because it's almost like the outside influences are less impactful, or that, you know, you're making the effort to bring those in as opposed to just being constantly bombarded very easily, I guess. You really had to work for it. And that's something that I think is harder maybe for people to realize today.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's an interesting point. Can we talk a little bit about who are some of the unsung heroes of Japanese photography? I mean, I have a little picture of Daido on my wall here that just sort of like is a little bit of an inspiration. And I think many of my listeners would be familiar with his work and Araki's work, but certainly from a historic standpoint, are there a few sort of touchstone photographers that maybe people don't know about or should know about?
I think Dōmon Ken, if we go a little bit further back, so one of the photographers who is kind of seen as, you know, the kind of by many people called like the father of post-war photography, who also actually got his own museum at some point in the 1980s, so before there was any other photography museum in Japan. So that already shows you how important he is within Japan, or he, you know, is seen as within Japanese photo history. Yeah, he's definitely someone to, his work about like Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I mean, yeah, he's just a really very good photographer. And I think then also some of the other vivo photographers are maybe, they are known if you know about Japanese photography, but if you maybe don't know as much about Japanese photography, names like Kawada Kikuji are not as well known. Hosoe Eiko for sure. I wrote a short text about his work recently for his 90th birthday for Aperture magazine. He was quite big in the US at the beginning of his career, interestingly. So he got, he made this wonderful book, Ordeal of Roses. Is that actually the English translation? I think it is. Barake, in which he takes photographs of Mishima Yukio, so a writer and a nationalist who then committed a very spectacular suicide through seppuku, so what you call harakiri in English, mm-hmm. So cutting his stomach. And the photographs of him, I guess, are kind of the best known photographs by Hosoe Eiko overseas, or the Kamaitachi series. And so he actually created these very, very theatrical photographs in which he works together with some kind of performers. So be it Mishima Yukio, or then other kind of actors, dancers. So photography has always really kind of collaborated with his photographic subjects, who has always credited his photographic subjects, and who has always seen photography as a kind of collaboration. He is, I think, a very important figure for the history of Japanese photography in the 20th century, who then somehow you know, is still a little bit under the radar, despite, you know, the fact that he had a gallery and a Rose Gallery in New York and was represented there and was quite big early on. But now, I mean, there still hasn't been a big proper museum retrospective show outside of Japan for his work. So he is definitely, for me, an unsung hero of Japanese photography of the 20th century.
I'm just thinking, like, somebody should put together a retrospective of his work, and like, maybe you can do it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And then Ishiyuki Miyako, of course, well, I think she is now already better known, but you know, just also a female photographer into the mix, because Japanese photography has been really male dominated and was dominated by men until the 90s and early 2000s. Now things really have changed. But until then, I think it was quite difficult for women. And there were female photographers, but they were just very often kind of under the radar. But Ishiyuki Miyako is a bit of an exception. She won the prestigious Kimura Ihe Award very early on, which is kind of seen as the most important photography award within Japan. And she had a retrospective show at the Getty. And so she is now, I think, you know, people know about her work, But yeah, the women, there are quite many unsung heroes as well.
Yeah, and I would assume that the causes of that male-dominated photo world is obviously a reflection on just sort of like the mechanisms of a lot of society. But is that something also maybe not unique to Japanese culture, but is it also a reflection of Japanese culture that there are fewer female voices or just photographers in general?
Yes, I think. Yeah, I mean, Japan definitely has a kind of macho, you know, kind of Japanese society still up to this day has this kind of macho element, I would say, at least, you know, in the 20th century. I don't even want to say that it's something that very historic, but it's actually probably more kind of also has something to do with Western influence, I think.
Sure.
But then also, if we go back to this whole camera thing, you know, kind of camera love and these, if we imagine the photography world in the post-war years in the 20th century as this kind of world that is dominated by these photography clubs, and all these guys who talk about the camera equipment, then we can also imagine that maybe for some women that wasn't as exciting. I don't know.
Maybe don't want to be in a room full of men with their lusting over their cameras,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. But then, I mean, talking to people like Ishiyuki, she said, you know, she was really, you know, felt quite welcome in that world in a way. So, you know, she then she called Moriyama Daido because somebody had said, "Oh, your work looks a little bit like his work," and you know, and he was already kind of better known at the time. And she just rang him up and said, "Oh, you know, people say that my work looks a little bit like your photography, and I have an exhibition coming up. Do you want to come?" And then apparently he came, and you know, was looking at her work. And so in a way, maybe these, you know, it's also, it's, yeah, you know, not, I don't want to, it was definitely difficult for women, but there are women who were kind of active already at that time and who've produced interesting work, and we just need to find out about it.
Obviously the representation of women in art in general, photography, more specifically, and Japanese photography. And I think of Araki's photos or this hypersexualization, or like, I'm guessing that also created maybe an environment that made it difficult for women photographers to sort of, you know, navigate. But later than in the 90s and then into the 21st century, it seems like the specifically the women photographers of Japan were reacting to that representation or that sort of world that had been created, and that probably fueled their work and their notoriety or presence on the scene. Would you say that's accurate?
Yes. I mean, the most interesting kind of thing is that if we think about the kind of so-called girly photography movement, which then kind of started in the early 2000s, and the Kimura Ihe Award, which I mentioned earlier, this main photography award, is quite interesting because there were then suddenly three women who shared this award, and that was Nagashima Yurie, Ninagawa Mika and Hiromix. And I guess in the West, Hiromix is particularly kind of then also became a bit of a star. And you know, on the jury, of course, they were all men. But they found this photography really refreshing and said, you know, they were able to see something in these photographs that otherwise they wouldn't have been able to see. And I think that really, really changed things dramatically, the fact that those three young women won that award. And it's interesting because you mentioned, of course, the kind of sexualization of women in photography. If you look at how these three women then dealt with this sudden enormous fame, we on the one hand we see Ninagawa Mika, who's actually now one of the most successful photographers and film directors in Japan, like a very, very strong woman artist who's just producing so much amazing work, and who's really big in Asia. Actually, she has massive solo exhibitions in other East Asian countries in particular, but still in the West it's not really as well known. She produces a lot of commercial work as well, and she really used this girly photography movement and this trend and this attention that she got. And then people like Hiromix, who, I mean, they were all really young at the time, and I sometimes wonder if the choices that she made were, you know, were to her best, because she then, you know, starred in like mayonnaise advertisement and things like that, and was a very pretty girl, and so was kind of used by the media in a way, and kind of also just struggled a little bit mentally. And then Nagashima Yurie was an artist who really kind of wanted to be seen, wanted to be taken seriously as an artist. And she actually left for the US and studied there for a while. And then when she came back, it became a little bit more quiet around her for a while. But now she's having all these different exhibitions. And she does a lot of work in photography, but also in various other media. And she also published a book about girly photography in Japan. But kind of in hindsight, looking back now, they really inspired so many women to take photographs, and who then felt, oh, you know, they're successful as photographers. I can be maybe successful as a photographer too. Because many of those women said at the time, oh, you know, photography for me was something that a middle-aged man would do. It didn't even appear to them that it's something that they could do as well. And that has certainly changed.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So how about we get to the last question? Are there any contemporary photographers that we should know about that may not be familiar to Western audiences?
Oh, there's so many. So it's always difficult when I get asked that question. I personally still really like Tokyo Rumando's work, who is a photographer who actually started off by being a photographic model, including for Araki. Interestingly, and then she decided that she wanted to be behind the camera and wanted to the one who to quote her to create the world, you know, the photographic world basically. And I think her work is really exciting. It's a lot of kind of performative work, a lot of kind of self portraits in different kind of costumes as well, and just very experimental and just very strong, kind of in terms of the photographic expression, and also very good in terms of the printing. Another photographer that I find really interesting is Nishino Sohei, who I also included in a recent exhibition 2 years ago at the Ashmolean Museum called Tokyo Art and Photography. And what Nishino does is he creates these diorama works, and he walks through a city, like, for example, Tokyo, and takes loads of photographs over long period of time, for example, 2 weeks or so, and then he combines these little photographs and then creates his own portrait of a city, if you will. And so this act of walking through a city is something that's really key for his work. I think he's also very, very interesting.
Yeah, great. And I think I've seen some of his work sort of like almost like wall-sized collage of like multi sort of views and just sort of overwhelming sort of landscape views of the city, right?
Yeah. But all, you know, kind of hand work of like sticking these little kind of photos together. So in terms of the manual labor, actually, also just really impressive. Just the craft is impressive. Yeah.
Well, great. Well, maybe this is a good place for us to wrap things up then. Lena, thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation with you and really appreciate you taking out the time to talk with me for my podcast today. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
So there you go, folks. My conversation all about post-World War II Japanese photography with Lena Fritsch. And I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. There's this whole world of photography out there just waiting to be discovered. And as we were talking about Japanese photography that was going on sort of unknown to Western audiences, it just made me think there must be worlds of international photography that's going on right now that I probably don't know anything about. And that's one of the joys of photography, is making those discoveries. And so I hope that you got a lot from this conversation. I will definitely share links to many of the photographers that Lena mentioned in the interview, and I'm going to verify pronunciation and spelling on all of those, so I'm passing on accurate information to all of you. If you have any questions about today's episode or any other episodes, go to the website, righteyedominantpodcast.com. You can leave me a question or comment way down at the bottom of the page. You'll also find all my previous episodes there as well. Also, if you could leave me a rating or a review, if you haven't done so already, I would greatly appreciate it. We're barreling towards the end of season two. Just got a couple more things to edit and get out into the world, and then I'm going to take a much needed summer break. But want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in and listening all throughout the season. It's definitely been a satisfying experience for me. So that's it for this episode. This has been the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I have been your host, Nick Toro Jr. And until next time, stay well.
This podcast has been a production of righteyedominant.art. The music for today's episode is brought to you by The Connet Project and Yazar.